Thanks for tuning in to Christian Medical and Dental Association's chapel. May the message be a blessing to you.
Those of you here last month, we're going to continue what we were talking about with what's going on with abortion now being legalized. You read about it every day just about in the news and what's going on state by state. And there's many other issues that we face in our culture. Physician-assisted suicide is still being fought all across the country as legalization is attempted state by state. I just thought back after Roe versus Wade was reversed, how God had prompted us to begin training members to be state reps over a dozen years ago, not realizing how important that would be, not just with physician-assisted suicide, but now with the abortion issue, to have media trained and prepared and experienced people to be leading the charge state by state on these important issues. But we don't have to leave it up to others. We need to have ourselves educated well enough about these issues that we can be comfortable in a conversation with someone we know or prepare something and give to our church or Sunday school class to help them understand how to defend these issues. Many people know what they believe but don't know how to defend it and are afraid to do so. And so we went through about a half a PowerPoint presentation. This is available on CMDA's website. Somebody contacted me afterwards. I assume it's still there. And wanted this to use. Plagiarism is the nicest form of appreciation. So feel free to take this, put your name at the top of it, use it, cut it up, do whatever you want if you want to do something with it, because we need to prepare God's people well to defend life. We finished up a little after this, but I just wanted to review the hierarchy of inalienable rights. This comes from the Declaration of Independence, saying we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And this is where we've made some of the biggest mistakes in the history of the United States, not understanding that there's a hierarchy to inalienable rights, that some rights trump others. And that's what this picture actually shows you, that life trumps liberty and liberty trumps happiness, or the ability to make money, enjoy property, own a home. All those things come under happiness. And back during Civil War, we had slavery before then, and they believed that the right to own property superseded the slave's right to liberty. We had a war over that, a terrible war. And a huge issue. And in Roe versus Wade, back in the 70s, they made the mistake at the Supreme Court thinking that liberty, the woman's right to choose, my choice, my body, my right, all those slogans that you hear, superseded the child's right to life. Obviously, it's not just her body, it's someone else's body she'd been destroying. And when you don't have this hierarchy of inalienable rights, you make some very serious issues. We've had conflict and 60 million deaths in this country because they created this right to liberty to abort your baby. So these are big issues. And what the other side says, it's important to know what those that oppose to you say. I often, when I'm in bioethical circles and sometimes on the media, say when people decide they want to do something that really is unethical, they bring in ethicists to justify what they're doing. And that's what's happened on the whole abortion thing after 1972. And they say that your personhood is not based on the fact that you're a human being. You're not really a person, because to be a person, you have to have some capability, what they call capability markers. You have to have rational attributes. You need to have self-awareness to understand that you exist. Obviously, babies don't have that. They have to have the ability to reason, and they don't define how high that level must be, but the ability to reason. You'd be able to interact with the environment, maybe to feed yourself or do other things with the environment. And then you have sentience, the ability to experience. You have consciousness. You have the ability to feel pain. You have the ability to feel pleasure. You have emotional responses. And if you don't have those, you are not a person. So what happens here is a group of people come along and decide what makes you a person. It's not something that's inherent to you because you're a human being born in God's image. It's something that you earn by getting these capabilities. And these things aren't available to a newborn baby or a baby in utero, but they're also, think about it, some mentally handicapped people don't have these capabilities. People that are comatose don't have those capabilities. When you go into surgery, I had a hernia repaired a number of months ago. They put me under. I don't remember a thing. I had a colonoscopy. So was I not a person during that time? See, these things lead you down paths that become very, very dangerous. And people promote these. This is Peter Singer. Peter is the professor of ethics at Princeton. And he thinks animals have more rights than you do if you're a young person. He says this, a week-old baby is not a rational and self-conscious being, and there are many non-human animals whose rationality, self-consciousness, awareness, capacity to feel pain, and so on, exceed that of a human baby a week, a month, or even a year old. If the fetus does not have the same claim to life as a person, it appears that the newborn baby is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. Think about that. And others agree with them. There's a lot been written on this by a whole bunch of very secular ethicists. One of those is Peter Fry, and he's a senior scholar at the Hastings Center, which is a big think tank on bioethics. And he pushes Singer's logic to the next level. He says, well, then the mentally ill human beings are therefore also not persons, and therefore they might be used in purely destructive experimental research in place of higher animals who are persons. So your chimpanzee's a person, the pig's a person, but mentally ill patients are not. This sounds off the wall, but this is being practiced in many places. For example, this is a medical journal from Australia, and a couple of authors there from Melbourne said that circumstances occurring after birth, such as they would have justified abortion, what we call after-birth abortion, should be permissible. The moral status of individual killed is comparable with that of a fetus on which abortions in the traditional sense are performed, rather than that of a child. So if you don't get what you want when you deliver your baby, you should be able to take it back to the hospital so they can dispose of it. These ideas are dangerous. They're dangerous for the 60 million kids who have been killed and increasingly dangerous for those after birth. And you say, oh, well, that never happened. It's already happening in the Netherlands. If you have a child that has some sort of disability, you can take it back to the hospital, or even while you're still in the hospital, they'll take it and give it a lethal injection and kill the baby. These ideas are dangerous. You hear a lot of arguments coming back at you when you get into talking with people about this. Let me tell you how I handle some of them. I remember back when we were looking at embryonic stem cell research. Let's sacrifice embryos so we can understand disease and get stem cells and treat disease and all those things going on. And Arlen Specter, some of you older folks may remember him, he was a senator, very pro-life, he said. But he said that really it's not a human person until it's implanted. It has to be in contact with the mother and have hormonal signals going on, and that let him justify voting for embryonic stem cell research because these embryos had not been implanted. Well, essential nature of a baby is not dependent on hormonal signals. But the easiest way that I've handled this in a very quick way, I said, well, if that's the case, what's going to happen when we have an artificial womb? Because they're working on that. The ability to actually have a child develop or transplant a child with a problem from the mother's womb into an artificial womb and let it continue to grow. When those babies are born, if that happens, would they not be persons? They've never had hormonal signals from their mother. And that very small example makes that argument go away. Embryo wastage, I've heard this one. Dr. Stevens, isn't it true that 50% of embryos don't implant or there's a miscarriage? Often the mother does not even know about it. And so how can you say that these are persons? Well, personhood is not dependent on survival rate. And then I go on to say this. When I was in Mogadishu doing emergency relief work, half the kids were dying from disease, starvation, and war. Does that mean they were not persons because their survival rate was only 50%? That's illogical. Another person I was actually debating, there used to be a channel called Tech TV, and they asked me to be on, and it was a debate. And I think we were talking about abortion or embryonic stem cell research, I can't remember. But the guy I was debating said, Dr. Stevens, how can you say that this is a person because natural twinning takes place? One embryo can split and make two persons. So how can you say that that embryo is a person? I hadn't thought about that, and God kind of gave it to me. He said, I turned to him and I said, well, if that is so, pretty sure you are not going to be a person. Because as soon as I can clone you, I can make you into two persons. So if being able to do that makes you not a person yet, then you won't be a person. It got real silent on the set. Brain development. People will say to me, well, Dr. Stevens, isn't it true that babies don't have brain waves to around 45 days of development? And so how can you say that they're a person if they don't have brain waves? When someone has had brain trauma and they check and they don't have any brain waves, you say they're dead and you can unhook the respirator. And so how can you say that an entity without brain waves is a person? Well, lack of brainwave activity in a fetus is not a sign of death. It's actually or a marker of life or personhood because they have the full potential to develop brainwaves. That person in the ICU does not. We know that they're not going to come back later. The brainwaves are gone. You've tested it a couple times. You know they're dead. Others have said, well, it's the ability to sense pain. Ability to sense pain, the whole idea of the characteristics, those capabilities. And so, well, that confuses the sensation of harm with the reality of harm. Great example of that I use with medical students. I would say to them, I wonder what if you all had some pain in the right lower quadrant and nausea and you just don't feel good, and being the good doctor that I am, I have to come up here and we'll examine you, and I think it may be appendicitis, and we do a few tests, we need to take you to surgery, and I've done a lot of appendix, and we'll get that out for you, and you know, put you to sleep, and I'll pray with you before I do that, and you know, you'll be really feeling good about me as your surgeon. And but you know, I never really liked medical students. And so after you're asleep, I just turn the anesthesia up and knock you off. Have I harmed you? You didn't feel a thing. You didn't know it was coming. Of course I've harmed you. The reality of harm doesn't mean you have to have the sensation of the harm occurring. So the idea that a baby can't sense pain has nothing to do with what that entity is, what that fetus represents, which is a person. The Supreme Court, in their decision in Roe versus Wade, based this on viability, the ability of the child to live outside the womb made them a person and someone that couldn't be killed. That was the initial thing they decided. Of course, it was expanded beyond that. Well, viability is not something that we can precisely measure. It differs with each child. It continues to change. I remember when I was in residency, we used to say, well, 28-week gestation, you know, the chance of survival without some major disability it wasn't very good. And that now, clear down to 24 weeks, we can have viability. We get an artificial womb, we might be able to do it almost at any time in gestation. But this is dependent on men's technology, not the essence of what the child is, which is a person. And then lastly, and that was what Sanger wouldn't even agree with, birth. But you know, there's no difference between the day before birth and the day after. It's just a commentary on the location of the child and the degree of dependence that child has. And actually, for the mothers in here, you would agree with me, it's more dependent on you the day after it's born than it is the day before born. Everything's just kind of on automatic pilot in utero. Now you're getting up the night, changing, breastfeeding, changing diapers, and the dependency seems to increase after birth. And so that is not a marker of personhood as well. These are the main arguments that you often hear when people are fighting this. We have a moral responsibility from God to protect life. It's not enough to have the opinion about abortion, physician-assisted suicide, sacrificing embryos, and a host of other issues, but God says that man is not to take life unjustly. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made men. Genesis 9:6. So, God is very clear about this. We have a responsibility to protect life and to defend life. Psalm 82:3, defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. I often think of that word fatherless because in the United States, you don't have to have the father's permission, the woman doesn't, to abort the baby. So that child really is fatherless in that sense. And often it's the poor that are dealing with this, but others, many others do as well. But God says to defend life and to do justice and take care of the afflicted and the needy. So knowing what we mean, what it means to be human, how do we respond to future medical and ethical issues? We have to stand up. And that's what CMDA has done for years. Since second week I was at CMDA, we used to have ethical statements, but there was never any statements from the organization. And 2 weeks after I arrived, John Embody walked into my office and said, here, this happened in the newspaper, why don't we send out a news release? And we did, and the Associated Press showed up, and that's how the ball got rolling. And then since then, there's been thousands of interviews by our members and news releases and all the rest of it. We've talked about abortion, and you know, when you really boil it down to get away from the ethicist and everyone else, whether an unborn child is going to be born or not or aborted is based on whether the mother wants it or not. As crass a reason as that. If it's wanted, it has enormous importance. If it's not wanted, then the doctor will prescribe some pills or do a surgical abortion. Embryonic stem cells, we don't hear much about this now because that was a huge debate in the early 2000s with all the promises of we were going to cure diseases. And I remember as we fought against this, we said there's another option, and that is adult stem cells. And soon after that, the technology was created where you could take skin cells or any cells, scrape the inside of your cheek, and in the lab, they can turn those into cells that are like embryonic stem cells. What can you do with that? That means they can take those cells and try to guide them into developing into a different type of tissue. Embryonic stem cells can become what we call totipotent. They can turn into any cell in the body over time as you develop. So they can be tongue cells, or they can be skin cells, maybe liver cells or whatever. Well, if you could guide those cells to turn into something, what could you do with someone in renal failure? Create an artificial kidney from their own cells? What about somebody that has alcoholic hepatitis and destroy their liver? Someone with a stroke? The potential for what these might be able to do is huge. Guiding them to that point is the difficult part. But a lot of efforts are being put into that and a lot of money because there's a wide hope that this can help. But you don't have to kill an embryonic human person to do it anymore. And there were all sorts of problems in doing that. because not only was it immoral, but it violated the medical code that you don't destroy life. It was impractical. It was estimated to cost $200,000 a person just to develop the embryonic stem cells. It would take 85 million women donating eggs to do this, to try to treat diabetes. It just all sorts of things went on. And of course, you take these cells from an embryonic embryo, then when it's transplanted, you still have rejection of the patient's body. So then how do you handle that? It was just all sorts of things that weren't going to work. And fortunately, we got another solution. There's still some embryonic stem cell research going on, but nothing to the level as it used to be. Physician-assisted suicide is in a number of our states, from California, Oregon, Washington, and others trying. I think last year there were over 30 states that tried to legalize this. This is the whole premise that some people have lives not worthy to be lived, and they are terminally ill, but as we've seen in other areas, it goes from being done for terminal illness to being done for chronic illness, to no physical illness at all, but only mental illness. In Holland and other countries in Europe, you can do this if you're just depressed and the doctor will help you kill yourself. And of course, this destroys trust, the foundation of the doctor-patient relationship. You go to the doctor, you walk in, you can't read his prescription if he writes it by hand, because that's one of the marks of someone that went to medical school, that you can't read their writing. Tony Evans says you shouldn't trust a doctor that you can read their writing. Now it's all electronic, so that solves that problem. But it destroys trust. I mean, somebody will come in and tell me things as a physician when I was practicing that they wouldn't tell anyone else, intimate things about what's going on, and they'll trust me to do surgery, trust me to give medicine. That's the foundation of the doctor-patient relationship. Can you trust a doctor that will kill you? The answer is no. I could convince you that physician-assisted suicide was a good idea just by how I described your diagnosis and your prognosis to you, and never say the word. I can give you hope or I can give you despair, and how I do that and the attitude I do with it and the words that I use. It's dangerous for patients. There's a slippery slope, like I was talking about. Once you can do it for terminal illness, then what about chronic illness? Somebody's going to suffer for a few months with terminal illness, but my goodness, rheumatoid arthritis and other diseases, you suffer for years. Don't they deserve not to suffer? And it just goes on and on of how people justify doing this, including doing it to the newborn. And it's always good to remember that suicide is not illegal. Used to, you couldn't get buried in the church cemetery if you commit suicide back hundreds of years ago. But suicide's not illegal. This is not about giving doctors, the patients, the right to die. This is about giving doctors the right to kill. And that destroys medicine. That slippery slope is very dangerous, especially for the elderly and the disabled. I remember picking up an article out of California, and a lady just kind of gave a synopsis. She said, you know, I've got some illnesses, and I'm living with my daughter, and my memory, you know, I'm having trouble with my short-term memory. And she told me one day that she thought physician-assisted suicide was all right. So I sit here day after day knowing what I'm supposed to do. And so people actually encouraging family members to do that, maybe because they want their inheritance or it's just too much trouble to take care of them. Once you put these things in place, it really becomes problematic. And it was interesting. I just look up the statistics in Oregon, where this has been practiced. Last year, they did 238 physician-assisted suicides, and out of 45,000 deaths. 45,000 deaths and only 238. I mean, if there's such a big need for this, if people are so desperate for this, then why aren't more people utilizing it? It tends to be people that are highly controlling, people that are atheistic or agnostic, and I'm going to control my life, and I'm going to make the decision when I die, and I'm going to go my way. I was exercising this morning to Apple weightlifting, and they were saying, let you be you. As you do this, let you be you. All this kind of stuff pervades us in our country. And we will get into human cloning and genetics. We will move on real quickly here. Cyborgs, this is stuff that's coming. This, and watch a news show when one of the guys lost both of his legs. The governor of Texas lost his legs. A tree fell on him when he was running. That was kind of scary. And so we're developing artificial ability to build limbs and all sorts of things. Well, the key thing is, how do you connect them to the brain? Wouldn't it be nice instead you could just actually take that arm and your brain could tell it how to? Well, they're already beginning to do that. In fact, they have got the ability to control a computer with a direct implant in the brain where you can move the cursor and click. This stuff is coming down the way. And those are wonderful technologies for some people, but where do you draw the line? When do you become to do enhancements? You think of the military applications of this. Let's make it stronger, more invulnerable, and all the rest of it. And that is all being helped by the nanotech revolution. The nanotech revolution is the ability to create little robots. We've got a member that does this. I mean, he created this little car that's molecule size. You have to have an electron microscope to see it. And this technology holds great potential. You got atherosclerosis? We'll give you an injection of nanobots, and it'll go in there and chip those things away, dissolve them, and excrete them through your kidneys. Well, that sounds pretty good. But where do you draw the line? That's the key things with these new technologies. They're very seductive. I've turned to a group of medical students and say, hey, listen, if I could plant a nano computer in your brain, and every night as you lay down, you got all the new medical data you needed. In fact, you didn't even have to study in medical school. You just have it. Would you take it? Every hand goes up. Every hand goes up. So we create superhuman beings. And then you have the enhanced and the unenhanced. You think we've got social divisions now. Can imagine what that would be. And then there's a lot of work going on in genetic engineering. Capacity to create novel organisms. Let's combine tissues or cells from separate species, or let's combine genetic information from different species. You say, oh, that, maybe that's too wild. It's already going on. Out at California, Irvin Weissman at Stanford has created a human mouse, and it has a 1% brain cells of a human being, looking at how we can make drugs more effective. All good reasons to do this. Somebody asked him, what are you going to do if it starts acting human? Oh, we'll kill it. We'll kill it. So what level should it be? Should it be 5%, 10%, 20%, 30%? Maybe we'll just have an accident and have this happen. These type of things get into some really difficult problems. Why would you do this? Well, there's some good applications if you do the right thing, like growing a liver in a pig for a liver transplant or a heart transplant. If you could make it so the human body didn't reject it, you wouldn't have to take all that chemotherapy, those drugs for years to keep rejection from taking place. So there's good reasons to do some of these things, but the trouble is our technology is expanding faster than our ethics, and people aren't drawing lines like they should. And then you have the whole issue of enhancement, the whole same thing with the military or others. Let's put some cheetah genes in you so you can run faster than anyone else. Or let's give you some eagle genes so you have eyesight like an eagle. They already have one. It's a Schwarzenegger mouse. They put some genes in to make this mouse stronger than any mouse that's ever lived by combining genes from different things. I told you chapel is going to be interesting today. And then there's the last thing, posthumanism, transhumanism. Everybody wants to live forever. Some people, a lot of money, may have their body put in liquid nitrogen. So if some discovery happens that can cure their disease or bring them back to life right after they die, after they've dead, then they could live again. But the idea about posthumanism is let's actually transfer your brain into a computer and then put it in a cyborg body, and you can live forever. Sound silly? Millions of dollars is being spent on this. How can I live forever? Let's close with this thought, or two other thoughts. Remember, God became an embryo. That just blows me away. God became man. And he could have come down to earth fully formed, like an angel would appear, there's Christ. But instead, he experienced every sphere of human development, including death, so he would have lived as we lived and understand us in a way that's only possible that way. God became an embryo, and therefore we need to defend those. One of my heroes, you don't know this lady, Mike does, and some others that have been to Tenwick. This is Edna Boroff. She's one of my heroes. She's about 4'8". She came out to Tenwick in 1947. Right after the war, she came in an Italian hospital ship that had been converted in 2 weeks, no, sorry, 5 days from a freighter to one that could hold people. She was with 17 other women in one room all the way across the Atlantic and to Cairo. And there she took two flights and finally got to Nairobi. She got to Nairobi, she went for 4 days in the back of a truck over rut dirt roads till she finally got at Tenwick. One of the first cases, she was a nurse, and one of the first cases they had, a man came in and a hyena had bitten off his hand. There were no doctors at that time. There was a nurse that had been there longer than she was, and she said, "You're going to have to help me with this case." And Edna fainted and fell to the floor. Right after that, the guy that had the hand fainted, lost his hand. She had a passion for life, and she loved to deliver babies. A busy obstetrician gynecologist in this country in their career, usually most OBGYNs do OB to about age 55, let her deliver around 6,000 babies. Edna delivered 20,000 babies. The career she was there when we came in the 80s. And she delivered a set of triplets soon after she arrived. And the woman barely made it in. She had the first of the triplets laying on the floor, not even get to the table. They got her up on the table for the delivery of the other two. And they were having breathing problems. They didn't have isolates, incubators back then. They put them in shoe boxes with a warming bottle, and Edna stayed up all night taking care of them. She didn't expect them to survive. Went down and got some breakfast while somebody else watched her in the morning, came back up. She spent hours and days taking care of those babies as she was doing other things as well. And by God's grace, they all survived. Before they got out of the hospital, the older Kipsigis man came to the door and angrily jabbering and trying to get in. They just had a small building there where the baby, all the work was done. And Edna couldn't understand the language well enough, so she locked the door. He was trying to come in. And finally some staff came out and started talking to him, came back to him and told Edna that he was there to kill the middle triplet. It was the father. And he said, "No, he's not drunk. He's because he has to kill that triplet, because they believed if they let the middle triplet live and it was a boy, the father would die, and if it was a girl, the mother would die if they let it live." And Edna put herself between this little 4'8" and this guy a number of times. And finally, he went away. They took the other two babies home, and Edna kept the triplet for 5 years. Single woman, still working at the hospital. Some of the women from the community would come in, and they want to see the baby because they wanted to see that they thought that they'd look at the hands thinking that they would be paws. They thought this was an animal. They would look at the feet to see if they were hooved, and they'd go back jabbering about it. Finally, the father came in and for another problem, and Edna went up to him and said, "Don't you want to see your son?" And he said, "Well, he's an animal." He said, "No, he isn't." And he ran right over and got up in his lap. And he looked at his hands and his feet, And she was trying to prove to him that he was this child was a human being, and he's not an animal. She kept saying, he's not an animal, he's not an animal. Finally, after 5 years, the guy went home. The mother came back and got the child because the old man had gotten so old and senile that he couldn't kill the baby. There are millions of Kipsigis today that don't kill their babies because of Edna when they're born as triplets. And she changed a whole culture. Little 4'8", German extraction, woman from Ohio, who spent her whole life loving those people, presenting them to Christ, and defending life. If she can do that, what's she want to do with us? What's God want to do with us? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, it's a serious topic. But you've put us in this time and place to be voices of righteousness, voices of reason, voices of love, demonstrating with our lives and our words that we value life because you value life and you value each child, every stage of development. Lord, help us to be bold, help us to be compassionate, and help us to make a difference. In your Son's name, amen.